elegant restaurant's carved wooden doors. Bottles of wine line a rack near the hosting station. A young man in a suit walks a blonde-haired woman and a young boy to the door.
Gotta go, Paul. I will see you later. Tell your dad I still make better pesto than he does, but I'll wait up for him anyway.
Bye, Mom.
I want to ask Dad something.
Make it fast, Chris is busy.
A title appears, A Stranger to Love. At a table, a waiter sets a birthday cake in front of a distinguished-looking man. Nearby, another waiter hands Paul, the manager, a bill. In the kitchen, Alan, the chef, places orders on a pickup counter.
Okay, people. We've got 5, 7, 15 ready to go. I need 2 mixed greens and a cold seafood on 10.
Mixed greens, cold seafood.
Crab cakes, asparagus, red pepper soup on 12.
Red cakes, asparagus, red pepper soup.
Reducts in the oven for 2.
What's in
the oven? Let me have a veal chop for Mr. and Mrs. Morgan.
Don't they ever eat anything else?
As my father used to say, as long as they eat it here, Al. There he is.
Hi, Dad.
Just the man I wanted to see. Come over here and taste this. I don't know if it's good or not. Now, this is hot.
Do it fast.
Okay.
The boy, Chris, dips his finger into a pan of tomato sauce. Paul walks in, frowning at the bill in his hand.
So?
Chris tastes the sauce.
It's good.
We can serve it.
Let's go, Chris. Come on, Mom's waiting.
Can I pitch you to one?
Yeah, come by tomorrow after lunch. We'll work on your curve. Hey, give me a little hug.
Ellen hugs Chris.
See you, Dad.
Love you.
He waves to his wife in the dining area, and she smiles, mouthing, see you later. Paul shows Ellen the bill.
You can't pick up the check for 6 people, Dad. That's the wrong way to make a profit.
It's okay, Paul.
No, it's $300.
It's good business.
That's how you go out of business?
That's Bob Hanley of Hanley, Osborne & Greer, one of the biggest law firms in Omaha. He's 52 today. The other guys are Osborne & Greer. They've been regulars for years offhand. I'd say they put you through school. Okay, I'll be right back.
Where are you going?
Hawaii.
On his way to the bar, Alan smiles at a customer.
Evening.
Hey, Alan.
Thanks.
The bartender gives him some bottled water.
You know, Steve is due for a raise, and I think we need a new compressor for the walk-in. That's a lot of money, Dad. So what are you going to do?
I'm going to wish Bob Hanley a happy birthday. Buy anyone who has to wait for their food and drink. And then I'm going to go back into the kitchen and do what I've done every night for the last 24 years.
You can't run a restaurant like this.
You'd do it different if you owned it?
As a matter of fact, I would.
Paul shoots Alan a hard stare and walks off. Alan tosses the bill onto the bar. He takes a sip of water, then grimaces and looks at the bottle. Later, Alan parks his Ford Explorer outside a large brick house. He gets out and opens an umbrella, then hurries up a walkway through the pouring rain. More titles. Produced by William Shippey. Written by Richard Leder. Directed by Peter Levin. On the front step, Alan puts down his umbrella and unlocks the front door. Inside, in a cozy living room, Alan's wife, Linda, sits on a sofa, typing on a laptop.
Hello.
Hi.
What time is it?
2:30. It was a late night.
You should have called me. I would have come back to the restaurant and kept you company.
I know. New schedules?
Busy work for Meals on Wheels. I really stayed up to talk to you.
Alan snuggles with Linda on the sofa and kisses her on the neck.
Hungry?
He glances at her, his lips downturned.
Oh, come on.
As they head into the kitchen, Linda rubs Alan's shoulders.
What's the matter?
Well, he's got a degree in restaurant management for all of 2 months, and he thinks he knows more about running the place than I do.
He's just trying to impress you.
Hanley's birthday, and he doesn't want me to pick up the check.
This isn't about Paul.
I've been doing the same thing for 24 years, Linda. 14 at my father's restaurant, 10 at my place. It's the only thing I've ever done since the day I graduated from high school.
It's the only thing you've ever wanted to do. To own your own place, to raise a family. That's what's important to you.
Is what we have all you've ever wanted?
Linda looks down, then meets his gaze.
Yes. It's a lot.
He hugs her tightly.
It's not about you. It's not about us. It's about me.
Well, then talk to me. Tell me what you're feeling.
Nothing. Empty. I don't know.
What can I do? How can I help?
I love you so much.
I know that.
It's just... Let me get some more milk.
He kisses her.
I'll be right back.
She nods. He leaves and Linda furrows her brow. Now at a convenience store, Alan buys some milk, then walks out. He passes a man with a mustache talking on a payphone. In the parking lot, Alan starts to unlock his Explorer. The man puts down the phone and grabs Alan from behind.
Give me the damn keys! Get your hands off me!
As he struggles to break free, Alan drops the milk. Another man pistol whips the side of his head and he falls against the Explorer, his wound smearing the window with blood. He collapses and strikes his head on the wet pavement. As Alan lies unconscious, the men quickly remove his wedding band, watch, and leather shoes. The man with a mustache takes Alan's wallet and strips him of his jacket, while his partner lifts the Explorer's rear door. They dump Alan's limp body into the back of the SUV, then shut the door. The man with a mustache picks Alan's jacket off the pavement, then hops into the driver's seat. The other man climbs in and they drive away. In the store, the clerk reads a newspaper. Later, the Explorer stops in a shallow riverbed. The two men lift Alan's limp body from the rear of the SUV and toss him face down onto a large flat rock in the water. They drive away. Alan's twisted body lies motionless, his legs dangling in the water. Blood pours from wounds on the side of his head, matting his short brown hair. Now, in a police station, two detectives meet with Linda and Paul.
The vehicle was found abandoned in the immediate vicinity of a convenience store robbery. There was blood in the back. It was O positive.
In Dallas? Bob, I don't understand.
Well, Linda, it's possible that whoever took Alan's car 2 weeks ago drove to Dallas, did the robbery, and then went out and found himself another car. That's not an unusual scenario for Grand Theft Auto.
But O positive is very common, right? You can't be sure it was my dad's blood.
No, that's why Detective Romero and his team are running a continuing check on every hotel, hospital, and jail in the state.
Linda and Paul lower their eyes.
We need to start checking the morgues. And although we can't be certain that's Alan's blood, evidence indicates that we're going to have to start walking down that side of the street if we're going to eliminate foul play as a possibility. And we're going to start compiling a list of all the unidentified bodies around the state. The computer will narrow the list down to reasonable matches, and then...
And then?
And then you'll have to visually ID those particular bodies.
And you'll call us if...
Absolutely.
I have to get back to the restaurant.
Paul stands, kisses his mom gently on the head, then shakes hands with Bob.
Thank you.
Detective Romero escorts him out. Linda sits at the table, dark circles under her blue eyes.
Coffee?
She shakes her head no.
You know, when I first met Alan, he was still working his father's restaurant. I was detective first grade.
Linda offers Bob a smile, then takes her purse and heads for the door.
Linda, if there's anything I can do for you...
You can find Alan and bring him home.
Bob gives her a friendly pat on the arm, then opens the office door. Now, Chris ambles down a sunny path surrounded by trees and tall bushes. Wearing a backpack, he stares solemnly down at the ground. Now, at a warehouse, Linda consults with a woman beside a truck marked Meals on Wheels. Linda climbs up some steps to a loading dock stacked with crates of food. She passes a man pushing a cart of beverage dispensers, then picks up the phone.
Hello?
Linda, it's Bob.
There's another body.
She closes her eyes.
Where is it?
Well, they pulled it out of the river. To the Carters.
Her brow creases.
Is it him?
Later.
The cause of death is a single blow, or more likely several blows to the head. The time of death is approximately 8 weeks ago, which is when Mr. Grant was first reported missing. The age of time of death is late 40s. Mr. Grant was 48. And there's an exact or near match with regard to the following: height, weight, general physical size and shape, hair color, eye color, hand and foot
Please.
Size.
Is it Alan?
What about fingerprints or dental records?
The coroner glances from Linda and Paul to Bob, then continues reading the chart.
The lower portion of the face, the jaw, mouth, and teeth have all been badly broken, but there's a general dental match considering the amount of decomposition and decay.
And the fingerprints?
We were unable to obtain readable prints. It's been in the river the entire 8 weeks.
Then you're not sure.
You're right. We have no way to positively ID the body.
Paul grips Linda's hand.
Bob tells me you've already done this a number of times.
Yes.
Well, if you'll follow me.
Bob comes over.
Linda, why don't we let Paul do this one?
Paul grips his mom's shoulder and nods reassuringly. He walks out, followed by Bob. Linda lets out a deep breath and turns back toward the office. Now Paul and Bob walk into the sterile morgue, their eyes fixed on a white sheet draped over a corpse. They exchange a sober look, and the coroner pulls the sheet back from the head. The dead man has short brown hair, and dried blood covers a wound near his ear. Paul stares at the corpse's face, then slowly turns away.
Are you certain? You're certain.
My father.
Okay, thanks, Marcus.
The coroner pulls the sheet back over the corpse's head. In the office, Linda waits, hugging her arms around her body. As Paul returns, she notices his somber face and shakes her head.
No. Oh, God.
Paul hugs her tightly, and she buries her face in his shoulder. Now Chris and four other boys kick soccer balls as they run down the tree-lined path. Chris breaks away from the group. Inside, Linda gazes at a Christmas tree. Chris barges in the front door and spots her.
Mom? What's the matter?
Come in, Chris.
Chris walks in and takes off his backpack.
Sit down.
He sits in a chair facing Linda, who forces a smile.
You know how we've all been trying to find Daddy. Captain Simpson and the coroner. Well, today we found him. He's dead, Chris. Your father's dead.
Chris jumps up and runs across the room. He leans his head against a door, sobbing. Linda walks over and wraps her arms around him.
I know, sweetheart.
I know. I'm so sorry. We did everything we could.
Chris wipes away a tear.
Your father loved you, Chris. Very much.
Linda kisses the back of his head. Now, in a cafeteria adorned with Christmas decorations, men and women in ragged clothes sit at long tables, eating off styrofoam plates with plastic utensils. At one table, a man with a scruffy white beard wears a ski cap with a gaping hole. Alan sits alone, wearing a dingy sweatshirt with a hood pulled over his head. Stubble darkens his worn face, and dirt covers his hands. Two workers walk over to his table and sit beside him.
Hi. My name's Russell. This is Diane.
We haven't seen you here before, so we thought we'd come over and say hello.
We thought maybe you could use some help.
Diane pulls back Alan's hood, revealing his head wound.
How did that happen?
I don't know.
Do you know where you are?
No. You're in Tucson. Arizona? Do you know how you got here?
His eyes distant, Alan shakes his head.
Look, we don't want to hurt you. We just want to get you some help.
What's your name?
Alan slowly looks up from his plate and gives Russell a vacant stare.
Oh, no. You don't know your name?
Just tell us your name, okay, so we can help you.
All we want to know is your name.
No, I don't know, all right? I don't know. I can't remember anything.
Standing, Alan backs away, then turns to hurry from the table. Later, Alan stands on a busy street corner, rubbing his arms for warmth. He wears a puffy ski parka, smudged with dirt over his hooded sweatshirt, with loose khakis and black sneakers. As he crosses the street, he pulls his hood over his head, then warms his hands under his arms. On the other side of the crosswalk, he turns and looks around, then wanders aimlessly down a sidewalk lined with shops. Our view moves above the city, revealing gently sloping mountains on the outskirts of town. The bright sun casts an orange light over the sky. Fade to black. Now a bus stops at the Tucson bus station. Several passengers climb off carrying their bags. They walk onto an open-air platform where people sit on benches underneath a slanted roof. Nearby, Alan stands by a ticket booth, staring wearily into the distance. He blinks, then looks around the station as passengers come and go. He turns and wanders across the waiting area. Alan stops suddenly, his eyes widening. A young boy with straight, light blonde hair stands with a blonde-haired woman beside a soda machine. As the woman puts coins into the slot, Alan slowly walks over, his mouth agape. The young boy turns his head in Alan's direction, meeting his gaze.
I know you.
The woman looks over.
I know you.
Just leave him alone. Don't touch him, please. Just leave us alone.
No, you have to help me.
We don't know you.
Two policemen walk up.
Hey, buddy, that's enough. Why don't you leave these nice people alone and come take a ride with us?
I know this boy.
Let's go, pal.
Oh, please, you don't understand. He can help me.
We understand. Why don't you talk to us instead?
Please, he can tell me who I am. I need to talk to him. I haven't done anything wrong.
Nobody said you did anything wrong. What you need to do now?
Sure.
Calm down and come with us.
I'm not coming with you. I need to talk to him.
One officer shoves Alan against a wall.
Okay, now listen carefully. This is what we're going to do. We're going to take a nice, easy walk over there. We're going to get in the car.
Oh, you're hurting me.
You got that?
Yeah.
Now in an office, Alan paces along a wall lined with windows. He still wears the hooded sweatshirt, but his face and hair are clean. Alan pauses as a bearded man enters the room, wearing a sweater vest with an ID card clipped to his tie.
Hello. I'm Dr. Friedland.
Alan turns back to a window as the doctor sits at a table.
You remember me?
Alan glances at him, then continues pacing.
Have you remembered your name?
No.
Tears well up in his eyes.
Do you know today's date?
He shakes his head.
Do you know what year it is?
No.
Do you know who the president is?
Smirking, Alan casts a sidelong glance at the doctor. The doctor leans back and tosses up his hands.
Do you know where you are?
No.
You're in Tucson, Arizona. This is the county mental hospital.
Why am I here?
You were at the bus station. You were bothering a 10-year-old boy. Do you remember that?
Yes, but I wasn't bothering him. I knew him. I think I knew him.
Who was he?
I'm not sure.
But he looked familiar.
Yes.
Alan purses his lips and looks out the window, his eyes wet with tears. The doctor writes in his notebook, then leans back in his chair. He takes a pack of cigarettes from his shirt pocket and sets them on the table.
You smoke?
No.
A hint of recognition flashes across Alan's face. His heavy-lidded eyes search the ground. The doctor studies his reaction, then writes in a notebook.
How long have I been here?
3 days.
This is wrong. I don't belong here.
That's what you keep saying, but you never tell me where you do belong.
I don't know. I told you I don't know. I can't remember.
Is it possible the truth is you don't want to remember?
Alan glances at Dr. Friedland, then laughs painfully. As he paces along the wall, a tear rolls down his cheek. The doctor sets his pen on the notebook, then slowly walks over to Alan.
Trust me. Tell me something about yourself.
I haven't broken any laws. You can't keep me here against my will.
After the initial 72-hour hold, I can order a 14-day stay if I'm not convinced it's safe to release you. When you're ready to relax, we'll talk again, okay?
Alan.
Excuse me?
Alan holds a hand to his head.
My name is Alan.
And your last name?
Gray. Alan Gray.
Good. Alan, that's a start. We'll talk again later.
Alan grabs his parka and leaves. Outside the office, he watches a nurse walk away from a nurse's station. He puts on his coat, then sneaks behind the desk and turns a key. A green light flashes and the hospital doors unlock.
Hey, you can't do that! Stop!
Alan jumps over a counter, then races through a waiting area where he steals a man's jacket. As he runs toward the doors, a man tries to stop him. Alan wrestles him to the floor, then heads for the exit. The man trips him, but Alan gets to his feet and runs out one door. Slamming it shut, he leans against it as the man and Dr. Friedland push on the other side. With the key, Alan locks them in, then pulls a fire alarm in a hallway. He races out of the hospital, then out into a busy street, dodging traffic. A car skids to a stop. Alan sprawls across the hood. He locks gazes with the driver, a heavy-set man with a salt-and-pepper beard. Alan scrambles off the hood, then dodges a passing car. The heavy-set man blocks traffic as he watches Alan run away. His mouth open, the man takes one last look, then drives off. Alan runs wildly down a sidewalk, looking over his shoulder. He clutches the stolen jacket in one hand. Fade to black. Now, in a snow-covered cemetery, mourners gather around a casket.
And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen.
Later at home, Chris sits in the living room by the Christmas tree. He picks up a knife from a wooden box and studies its carved handle and leather case.
Dad's knife.
Smiling, Linda takes it.
His grandfather gave him this when he was just a boy.
It's really old, huh?
Your dad had this with him on every camping trip we ever went on. You know, Chris, I think he would have wanted you to have it. He wanted you to love camping as much as he did.
She gives him the knife.
I wish I could have gone with him one more time.
Linda smiles, then takes an arrowhead from the box, running her fingers over its ridges.
Your dad found this on the very first camping trip we ever made to Mesa Verde. We hadn't been married very long. He said he thought it was an Anasazi arrowhead.
Anna what?
Anasazi. They were Indians. Their name means, the old ones. And they lived in beautiful cliff dwellings a long, long time ago. Your dad said he thought this arrowhead could bring a family luck.
Linda presses her lips together as she gazes at the arrowhead. Chris takes a baseball glove from the wooden box.
His mitt.
Mm-hmm.
Who's gonna play catch with me now?
I will. Or Paul.
You?
I'm not so bad for a girl.
I'm gonna keep this under my bed. Is that okay?
It's fine, sweetheart.
Wearing the glove, Chris gets up. Linda watches him go. Now in a dark alley littered with trash, a homeless man shuffles up to Alan, who sleeps huddled against a wall. Stirring awake, he glares at the man.
Move on.
The man leaves. Alan sits up and rifles through the pockets of the stolen jacket. He finds a leather wallet and opens it, then takes out the money. A police car turns down the alley, shining a searchlight on piles of garbage and broken-down appliances. Alan hunkers behind an old refrigerator and drops the jacket. Two police officers step out of the car and walk toward some homeless people sitting by a trash pile.
Okay, let's move along here. Come on, move it.
Alan takes off.
Hold it! Hold it!
The policemen run back to their car as Alan heads toward a busy street. A station wagon turns right into the alley, blocking the police car. Alan weaves his way through the traffic and reaches the other side of the street. The police car pulls out of the alley, following Alan as he runs down the sidewalk. He staggers toward the bus station, losing the policeman. Frantically, he looks around the waiting area, then stumbles up behind two customers at a ticket booth. One customer leans in toward the window. Alan looks over their shoulders, then hurries to the next window. A worker consults a schedule for a passenger. Alan runs to a third window and leans into the speaker.
I want to buy a ticket on that bus.
He hands the cashier his money.
That's not enough. It goes all the way to El Paso.
It's all the money I have.
Apache Springs is $14.80.
As the cashier rings up the purchase, Alan looks around impatiently. She hands him a ticket and he runs off. The police car pulls up near the ticket booth, its red and blue lights flashing. Alan quickly hops onto a bus and staggers down the aisle. He plops down in a seat, his chest heaving. As the bus starts to move, Alan leans back against the headrest, then lets out a deep breath. The overhead lights illuminate his haggard, unshaven face. The bus pulls out of the station. A company name on the side panel reads Southwest Transit. As the bus drives off, it passes the policemen parking their car along the curb. Now distant mountain peaks rise above a desert valley and a sprawling Pueblo-style hacienda. Near a garden path, a sign on a reddish-brown stucco wall reads, "The Inn at Apache Springs." In the inn's courtyard, Alan arranges patio chairs around a small table. Used wine glasses and an empty wine bottle litter the edge of a three-tiered water fountain. An auburn-haired woman steps through a screen door carrying a trash bag. She freezes, watching Alan pick up newspapers, then eat leftovers from a plate.
Hey! Hey! Excuse me! Excuse me. Don't touch those chairs, please. Listen, you've got to go.
Sorry, I didn't mean anything.
I understand. I have guests here. All right, so please, let's move along.
I don't know where I am. I thought if I could stay here, I could do.
You can't. All right, I'm real sorry about that, but you have to go. Come on, let's move along. Let's go.
Alan hesitates, the plate in his hands.
I wanted to...
I know. I understand. Please, just put that down and don't touch anything and let's go. Please.
He sets down the plate, then picks up a newspaper.
You just leave that. It's fine. Just leave it. I'll take care of it. Thank you.
Sorry.
Sighing, the woman watches Alan leave. He walks through an open-air cafe, then heads for a heavy wooden door.
Hey, excuse me.
He turns.
There's a shelter downtown at the Lutheran Church. They can probably help you there. And have a doctor look at that cut.
Thank you.
Alan pauses, then slowly turns and ambles down a walkway guarded by two lion statues. In the courtyard, the woman frowns, then looks at the messy table. She wears her long hair in a ponytail and a flannel shirt over her faded overalls. Outside, Alan stops and gazes out at the cacti and pale leafy trees surrounding the inn's sandy driveway. He turns and looks back at the hacienda, swallowing hard. Fade to black. Now Linda works at her kitchen table. She looks toward the front door, then sets down her coffee mug and walks through the exposed brick kitchen. In a hallway, a family photo and a portrait of Chris sit on a table. Linda opens the front door. Her blue eyes widen and she covers her mouth. Alan stands outside, a wide smile on his clean-shaven face. She reaches out to him.
It's you.
Alan takes her hands and pulls her close. They stand in the doorway, locked in a passionate kiss. Now in bed, Linda jolts awake. She sits up and rubs her eyes, then looks at the clock on a nightstand. She looks at the pillow lying on the bed beside hers. Gently, she rests her head on it, then runs her fingers lightly over the pink case. She gazes sadly at the pillow, creases lining her forehead. Daytime. At Alan's restaurant, the heavyset man with a salt and pepper beard strides into the dining room. Bob Handley shakes his hand as he heads out.
Oh, Don.
Hello, Bob. Hey, good to see you.
You too.
Bob leaves. The man spots Linda at the bar studying a bottle of wine. He walks over.
Thank you. Good.
Linda? Don Bradley. I own the Silver Grill over on Harris. We've met a few times.
Oh, of course. Don, you'll have to forgive me. I'm a little scattered these days.
It's okay. I miss him, too. I got to know him pretty well over the years. I considered him a friend.
Thank you.
That's sort of why I'm here. You see, I read the story in the newspaper about how he was missing for 8 weeks, and then the river and everything. And, well, I was just in Tucson. I had some business there. Now, I know this is going to sound crazy, and I probably shouldn't be here. But I swear to you, I'm sure that I saw Alan alive, running right across the street. He didn't look well. He was thin and dirty. But it was him, I'm sure it was.
Linda's face contorts in tears.
I'm sorry. I knew this was a mistake. Look, I'm really sorry. I don't know what else to say.
Did you speak to him?
No. There was too much traffic. He was in the middle of the street. I nearly hit him. He looked right at me. Then he was gone. It was him, Linda. It was Alan.
Later.
Mom, please, don't do this.
The coroner said there was no positive way to identify the body. That's what he said, Paul.
I know.
You were upset. The body was decayed. The jaw was broken. You had one quick look.
It was Dad.
Maybe it wasn't. Maybe you made a mistake. Maybe we buried the wrong man.
Mom, we all miss him. But we have to get on with our lives now. We have to pull ourselves together and move forward as a family. He would have wanted us to.
He's alive, Paul.
Mom!
Paul angrily sits beside Linda's desk in the restaurant office.
I felt something. Before, I didn't know what it was. I didn't know how to explain it. But I know what it is now. I'm not going to give up, Paul. He would never give up on me.
Paul meets her gaze, then looks down, pressing his lips. Linda takes her shoulder bag and starts to head out.
Where are you going?
I'm going to Tucson. Will you take care of Chris, hon? Tell him it's a business trip for Meals on Wheels.
Wait!
Now, at the Apache Springs Inn, the auburn-haired woman walks out a back door, carrying a paintbrush and two buckets of paint. She hurries down a small dirt embankment, then heads for a tool shed. Wearing a peach-colored shirt with jeans and white sneakers, she opens the wooden door. Inside, Alan lies on a concrete ledge. He stirs awake. The woman grabs a hoe and points it at him.
What are you doing here?
Please, I don't mean any harm.
I told you to go to a shelter!
I don't belong there.
Oh, you don't belong here. Come on! Come on, get out!
No, please, I don't want to upset you. Is there some job?
No! Come on! Go! Jimmy!
Now,
come on!
Alan gathers his coat, then steps out of the shed. He climbs up a low concrete wall, tripping over the paint buckets. He stumbles up the embankment, then hurries off. The woman lowers the hoe. Later, inside, the woman carries a laundry basket past the cafe. She smiles at a guest.
Hi.
Hi.
She passes more guests in the courtyard.
How's everything going?
Outside, two young boys play street hockey in the sand.
Come on, Danny, whack 'em. Whack 'em.
A bearded man smoking a cigarette watches them. He chuckles as he spots the auburn-haired woman walking up. She sets the laundry basket beside him.
Jimmy, I asked you not to smoke around the boys.
Hey, guys, come here. I need to talk to you.
Come on.
Listen, now.
Okay, there's a homeless guy hanging around the inn. I caught him sleeping in the shed.
You want me to get rid of him? I'll give him a beating.
No, he's already gone. I just want you to be careful if you see him, all right? All right? Anyone listening to me?
The boys stare at her, then keep playing.
What does this guy look like?
He's got scruffy hair, needs a shave, kind of a sad face.
You know, Andy, you know, you can't be too careful. You see this guy come around here again? I'm gonna kick his ass.
Oh, cool. Yeah! No, not cool. There'd be no reason to do that. He hasn't done anything to anyone. He's homeless, that's all. He'll drift away when he's ready. Now, I just want you guys to be careful if you see him, all right? Understand?
The younger, blonde-haired boy looks at her. The older boy keeps playing. Andy storms off.
Hey, Andy. How about my raise?
I know, Jimmy. I said when I can, all right?
She carries the laundry basket up some stairs.
Soon, right?
Soon.
Jimmy smiles and nods. Now Linda strides up a walkway to the Tucson Police Department. She wears a black blazer over a gray shirt and tapered jeans with flats. Later, in a lobby, Linda sits on the edge of her seat, twiddling her thumbs. She looks around distractedly, then lets out a deep breath. A man in a suit and tie comes down a staircase carrying a file. Linda spots him and sits up anxiously in her chair as he sits beside her.
I went back 4 weeks. Not a single Alan Grant, either arrested or detained anywhere in the immediate Tucson vicinity.
Did you check the hospitals?
No Alan Grants admitted anywhere in that same period of time. Now there is an Alan Gray who was picked up for vagrancy, resisting arrest, and harassment approximately 2 weeks ago. Now, could he be using a different name?
I don't know. What did he look like?
Delaney! Who was the arresting officer? This is Mrs. Grant, Officer Delaney. Do you remember that vagrant you picked up at the bus station a few weeks ago?
Yeah, the one that was talking to that kid?
Right. What did he look like?
approximately 5'11", unshaven, dirty clothes, dirty hair. Pretty beat up, between 45 and 55.
Linda takes a photo from her bag and shows the officer.
Is this him?
It's possible, but I'd have to say no. It's not the same man.
Oh, thank you.
Delaney starts to go.
Oh, what did the little boy look like?
10 or 12 years old. Blonde hair, blue eyes. Great big blue eyes.
Linda smiles slightly.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
The officer leaves. Linda puts the photo back in her shoulder bag, then stands.
I wish we could have been more helpful.
What happened to him?
Who?
Alan Gray. Is he still here? Is he under arrest?
No. He was brought over to the county mental hospital and released into their custody. He was gone 3 days later.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Sorry. Mm-hmm.
Linda shakes hands with the detective, then leaves. Now in the mental hospital, Linda sits in Dr. Friedland's office. The doctor studies a picture of Alan.
A man I know swears he saw him in Tucson. I really don't know what could have happened to him. He was having some sort of midlife crisis. Maybe he was disoriented or confused somehow.
I know you want to believe Mr. Gray is your husband, but the man who was in our hospital was not experiencing a midlife crisis. He was, in fact, suffering from some form of severe dissociative trauma, possibly a fugue state, possibly a delirium. I didn't have the opportunity to make a more accurate diagnosis.
But it couldn't have been him.
This man was hostile and aggressive, nothing at all like you've described.
Linda sighs. Later, she walks quickly across the hospital parking lot, clutching her keys. As she approaches her car, her face starts to contort. She unlocks the door, then breaks down in tears. Nighttime. At the inn, Alan grabs a piece of bread from a pile of garbage bags beside a dumpster. He takes a bite, then climbs over the pile and looks into the dumpster. In her office, Andy tosses a pen onto her desk and leans back in her chair. She stands and looks out the window. With an exasperated look, she presses an intercom on the wall.
Jimmy, are you there? Jimmy?
Why did I ever hire him?
Andy storms into the kitchen. Turning on the light, she finds the counters covered with food scraps and dirty dishes.
Damn it, Jimmy! I can't do this anymore. I told him I'm not to leave early, but does he listen? Nobody listens to me around here except me. I hear everything I say. I'm actually a very good listener.
She starts to put the food away. She marches to the back door and flips on an outside light. Grabbing a baseball bat, she storms toward the dumpster.
All right, come out of there. Come on, get out of there. I'm not fooling around.
She bangs on the side.
Now!
Alan peeks out at her.
All right, I'm calling the police.
No, wait, please, don't!
He climbs out of the dumpster and falls onto the pile of garbage bags below. Andy turns and frowns.
Please.
Sighing, she rubs her face.
Please. I'm hungry. I'll work. Wash floors, dishes, Andy.
Andy takes a deep breath and gazes at Alan, his face covered in sweat.
Please.
Fade to black. Daytime. Alone in the kitchen, Alan chops lettuce.
Nothing? It's not fair.
That's the way life is sometimes.
What? This is about money, right?
Bingo.
I told you I would give you a raise at the end of the month. You can't wait till then?
Yeah, well, I got a better offer in town. And guess what? It starts tonight.
I'm going to have a room full of people in there in a half an hour. What am I supposed to do?
I don't know. Is that my problem?
As Justin and Danny watch, Jimmy packs a bag. Andy leans against the kitchen counter and sighs.
All right, whatever they're paying you, I'll do better.
Okay, I'm listening.
Alan glances up.
Don't do it. Let him go, he can't cook anyway.
Yeah, right.
Good luck.
Jimmy picks up his bag and walks out. Andy smacks the countertop with both hands.
Great! Now what am I going to do? Who's going to cook?
She hits her thighs. Alan watches her pace. Sighing, he meets Justin's gaze, then grabs a kerchief and ties it around his neck.
Justin, you know how to run this thing?
Yeah.
Put on the apron. You're the man until we hire someone else. Danny, you're my first assistant.
Huh?
I'll tell you what to do, you just do it, okay?
Okay. Alan, what are you doing?
Making dinner.
Oh, no.
Relax, we can do this, no problem.
Oh, God.
Let's go, let's go. We got orders coming through that door any minute. You take care of the dining room, I'll take the kitchen.
I hope you know what you're doing.
Me too.
Wide-eyed, Andy walks into the dining room. The boys wear white aprons over their clothes.
Now that's a great-looking crew. Let's go.
Later in the bustling dining room, a fire crackles in the fireplace as a waitress serves entrees. Patrons sit at tables with deep blue tablecloths, sipping wine as they dine. Andy strolls through the restaurant. She looks around, an amazed smile on her face. In the kitchen, Alan sprinkles sugar into a simmering pan of spaghetti sauce, then stirs it with a wooden spoon.
Looking good. Looking real good. Okay, people. Take a minute. Tell me if I can serve this or not. Now, this is very hot. Do it like this.
He dunks his finger in the sauce. The boys try it. Justin gives Alan a high five.
All right. Now, trick is just a bit of sugar. Cuts the acidity of the tomatoes, lets the basil come to the front. Now, I'll serve this. You guys make two salads for table 10. How much dressing do they get?
Not so much if there's a puddle on the plate.
And not so little if they got surgery.
You got it.
Later in the empty dining room, Andy adds up receipts. The boys come in.
There they are. How'd it go?
Great.
Fine.
Where you going?
Good.
Yeah. Night.
See you tomorrow.
Grinning, Andy gets up and walks into the kitchen, where Alan holds a sauté pan over a burner.
The guys were asleep on their feet.
Yeah, they worked hard. I'm proud of them. They did great.
So did you.
I made dinner, that's all.
He adds liquor. It flames up.
I had no idea you could cook like this.
I don't know what to say. Just felt right, you know?
Yeah, it does. So, Alan, I want you to take Jimmy's job. I mean, I'm offering you Jimmy's job, and I want you to say yes. I mean, I hope that you'll say yes. And this isn't just about cooking. It's about the boys. They've really come to like you. And it's also about me. I want you to stay, too.
Alan's lips curve into a smile. He hands her a glass of red wine.
I'm not going anywhere, Andy.
He lifts another glass and a toast. They sip wine, then gaze at one another.
Come on, let's get a call.
Oh, right. Looks great. What is it?
I have no idea.
Now Andy and Alan stroll past a duck pond.
I want you to know the truth. I can't remember who I am, Andy.
Can you remember anything?
Some things. But it's not like remembering them. It's more like just knowing them. It's like having a sense that they're true.
Like what?
In the southwest corner of Colorado, there are these Indian villages, ruins, hundreds of years old. And I know that I've been there. I have another life. It's a good life. I can feel that even if I can't remember it. I may always be looking for her. I don't know where I belong.
You want to know what I think? I think you belong right here.
I don't care who you were. It's who you are now and who you're going to become from this point on.
He caresses her hair. The boys run up.
Hey, Alan!
Yeah, buddy?
Yeah, come on, Alan, come on!
Yeah, we need a pitcher.
Justin throws him the mitt.
Be right there.
The boys join a game on a baseball field in the park. Alan and Andy picnic on the grass nearby.
When Steve and I decided to give up our careers and buy the inn, I thought it was going to be easy. Live this nice, quiet life in the country, get out of Chicago. And then Steve died, and it was like, I feel like my heart just sort of shut down.
Alan takes her hand.
I don't think I'd ever feel anything again. And then you fell into my life and saved me.
No. You saved me. I remember that much.
Well, okay, so we saved each other. I don't want to think about the past. Let's think about now. You and me.
Alan leans closer and nuzzles Andy's cheek. Justin and Danny race over.
Hey, quit that! Get out of there, come on!
Baseball.
Yes, I remember.
I said I'd play.
Yes, you did.
They gaze warmly at each other.
I'm going now.
I can see that.
Alan leans over for a brief kiss. Giving Andy's shoulder an affectionate pat, he gets up and follows the boys to the field. As he slides his hand into the baseball glove, Alan glances back at Andy. She grins.
Make me proud!
Alan returns her grin and joins the game. Now in a hospital, Linda walks down a corridor with her son, Paul.
He's been on life support for 2 days, and they've been unable to locate any family.
And they're sure his name is Alan Gray.
A tall man wearing a business suit and a hospital ID badge approaches.
Thanks for meeting us.
The hospital administrator opens a door. Inside, a man lies on a bed, a white sheet covering him up to his chest. Tubes attach him to a respirator. Linda and Paul move closer to the man's bedside. Linda covers her mouth and looks away. Paul shakes his head at the administrator, then gives his mother a comforting pat on the shoulder. They leave the room. Later on the street.
That's the last one, Mom. You can't do this to yourself anymore. You can't chase down every Alan Gray in the state of Arizona. I'm not going to let you. You have to start your life again. You can volunteer like you used to. You can come and work at the restaurant if you want. You have to let it go. You have Chris to worry about.
Well, that's why I can't let it go.
And that's why you have to.
I'm not doing this for me. I'm doing it for you and Chris. You need your father.
My father's dead.
Linda fights back tears.
But we're still here.
Linda buries her face in one hand.
It's time to let him go, okay?
She shakes her head, her eyes full of tears. Paul gives her a hug. Now at the inn.
Hurry, come on.
The boys scamper to their bunk beds.
Get some lower sleep.
Yeah, try to behave yourself.
All right, wise guys.
Yeah, we'll be looking.
Yeah, I'm going to go downstairs and see what happens.
Out.
Tonight.
Good night.
Okay. We're looking.
We'll
watch for you.
Andy and Alan walk outside.
I can't believe those guys. Too much.
And Danny's will be dead.
We are in trouble.
We?
Down in the courtyard, Andy turns to face Alan.
Sorry, I...
What?
Alan gazes into Andy's deep blue eyes.
I need to ask you something.
What is it?
We haven't known each other very long, really. I care for you very much.
That's nice.
I'm very attracted to you.
That's nice, too.
And you said that I should think about us. And I have. I may never remember my past.
Okay.
What's real is you. I love you, Andy.
I love you.
They draw together in a long, lingering kiss. Andy wraps her arms around Alan and holds him close. Nuzzling her, Alan presses Andy tight against his broad chest. They pull slowly apart. Alan rubs Andy's back, then caresses her graceful neck.
Will you marry me?
Yes, I will.
Grinning, they embrace.
Should we tell the boys?
Tomorrow. We'll tell them tomorrow.
Holding Alan's hand, Andy leads him inside.
I've got plans for you.
Fade to black. Daytime. In the Courtyard Cafe, Bob Handley sits at a table with friends. Wearing his chef's jacket, Alan walks toward Andy. As they talk, Handley eyes them.
Boys back yet?
Oh, they're going to be at the Millers till after dinner.
Oh, don't worry. We'll tell them tonight.
How about after the wedding, we all jump in the car and go camping somewhere?
Oh, Alan, boys hate camping. They went with their dad once, and they had the most miserable time. They said they'd never go again.
But you...
Well, you know, actually, my idea of a vacation is going to a beach somewhere. Phones, no kids, no nothing.
Sounds boring.
So maybe we never get to the beach.
Alan. Alan, Grant.
Handley walks up.
Bob Handley. Omaha. This is incredible. I mean, it's you, Alan.
You know me?
Well, of course I know you. You're Alan Grant. Alan's. I eat at your restaurant 4 days a week. Here, look.
A matchbox.
Alan, this is you, Alan Grant. I know your wife, Linda. Your son's name is Paul.
I'm Alan Gray. That's me.
Alan walks away.
Alan. Wait. We all thought you were dead. I mean, it's been over 6 months now, but here you are.
You must have me confused with somebody else, Mr. Handley. My name is Alan Gray.
Alan Gray?
Yeah.
Come on, Alan.
It's not me. I'm not him, really. It must be some strong resemblance. My name... I'm not Alan Grant.
Well, it's the most remarkable resemblance I've ever seen, right down to that bandana you wear. All right, Alan Gray. All right. Nice to meet you.
Handley frowns as Alan hurries off. Andy watches, her brow pinched with concern. With her fingers laced, she walks slowly through the dining room among the tables, barely noticing the diners. In the kitchen, a prep cook chops a plate of onions at the counter. He hands the plate to Alan at the stove. Alan takes the plate, glances at it absently, then sets it aside. Walking across the room, he takes a piece of paper out of his shirt pocket. He dials a number on the wall phone.
Alan. Hello, Alan.
Yes, hello. Can I speak to Paul Grant, please?
Hold on.
Thank you.
You want me to fly to Sammy?
Yeah, right.
Paul Grant? Hello, this is Paul. Is anyone there? Hello?
Andy comes in just as Alan hangs up.
Who's that?
No one.
Alan turns away. Andy watches him with a frown. Later, outside, Alan walks up the steps to the terrace where Andy pinches buds off a bushy plant. A watering can and a crate of gardening tools sit nearby.
I spoke to that guy Handley again. He gave me the phone number for Alan's, and I got that woman's address, too. I called the restaurant and asked for Paul, and, I don't know, I can't explain it. When he came on, I couldn't recognize his voice, but I just knew it. Does that make any sense?
Nothing makes any sense. You know, Alan, this all could just be a big mistake. I mean, the guy could be wrong.
He was so sure, Andy, so sure I was Alan Grant. I have to find out if it's true.
So what are you saying?
can't move on without knowing the truth.
The truth. The truth is I love you, Alan. That's the truth.
Andy starts to leave. Alan stops her. He folds her into an embrace. She hugs him tight for a second, then pulls away. Now in Omaha, a mailman walks along the curved path to the front door of the Grant house. In the kitchen, Linda stands at the island, looking through papers. Chris eats a bowl of cereal.
Are you glad to be working again?
Yes, I am.
Richie Knight says Meals on Wheels is a really cool thing.
Richie Knight is a very smart boy.
Can I come with you sometime?
Yes, I'd like that.
On a school day?
Linda picks up mail off the floor.
You were doing very well up until then.
She looks through the envelopes, stopping at one with a handwritten return address of Apache Springs.
Oh my God.
She rips it open. As she unfolds the letter inside, her mouth falls open.
Alan?
She reads the handwritten words. Now, at the inn, the boys watch the prep cook.
No. You slice against the grain.
Oh, I get it.
Practice that. You'll be as good as me by the end of lunch.
Cool, you think so?
Mm-hmm. I'm counting on it. See, the idea is to teach you everything I know, then sit back and let you do all the work. I'll be the executive chef.
Then what do I be?
Overwork and underpaid.
Andy enters the kitchen, her face serious.
Alan?
Yeah.
This is Linda Grant.
Linda steps into the kitchen. She catches her breath when she sees Alan's face. He gazes back at her.
She got your letter.
Linda takes a step closer.
Hello, Alan.
Hello.
Alan stares blankly at Linda. Later, Alan leads Linda outside, keeping several paces in front of her.
She seems nice.
Yes, she...
He wanders ahead.
Alan?
He stops and turns around.
Look at me.
He gazes steadily at Linda. A furrow deepens in her forehead.
You don't know me? But it's me. It's Linda. I'm your wife.
I know you. I feel that. But I don't remember you. I don't remember us together.
Linda reaches into her shoulder bag and pulls out an 8x10 photograph. She hands it to Alan and he studies it. It shows Linda as a smiling young bride wearing a white wedding gown, standing with her groom, Alan.
Where are my shoes?
They were too tight.
I got married in my socks?
Well, everybody at the end of that day was in their socks.
Alan sits down on a low stone wall.
We were happy together, weren't we?
Yes, we were. We have a good life, Alan. We have a wonderful life.
Linda sits beside him.
But to tell the truth, before you disappeared, you seemed a little restless. Confused.
Confused? About what?
I don't know. Maybe you thought you'd lived half your life and you hadn't done all the things you wanted to. We've been together for 24 years, Alan. You're my best friend. My lover. My husband. And I missed you so much. You know, all I ever wanted to do was spend my life with you, and then you were gone, like that. We buried you. But I never gave up hope that someday I would find you. And now I have. And I can't bear to let you go again.
I can't remember you. I want to, but I can't find you in here. I can't remember.
But if you came home with me, then you'd remember.
No, I can't. I can't go with you.
Why not?
Because this is my life now. This is all I remember.
What are you saying, Alan?
Andy and I are getting married.
Linda fights back tears. She takes a folder out of her shoulder bag and hands it to Alan, then runs away from him down the driveway. Alan watches her go, then peers at the wedding photograph in his hands. In it, he wears a white tuxedo as he stands with his arm around his bride, Linda, a happy smile on his smooth, youthful face. Fade to black. Now, Alan carries the folder through the inn's empty dining room as waitstaff lay place settings atop the blue tablecloths. Andy looks up from arranging bright roses in a centerpiece. Alan stops and smiles sadly at her, then walks into the kitchen. At the counter, a prep cook wears a white apron as he carefully prepares vegetables. The other prep cook carries a melon over to the counter.
Okay? Yeah.
Alan puts the folder on a high shelf in an alcove. Nighttime. At the Grant house, Linda sits in the living room with her sons.
Does he love them more than us?
No. But he can't remember us.
How could he not remember us?
I don't know. But we can't force him.
What if he never does? Then what?
Oh, Chris.
She wipes away his tears.
We can't give up hope.
He pushes her hand away and runs out of the room.
Aren't you upset? He's not coming home.
Of course I'm upset. But at least he's alive, Paul. He is alive.
Standing at the fireplace, Paul looks at framed photographs on the mantel.
I wanted to be a chef. Just like Dad.
I remember.
He tried to teach me. But I wasn't a very good student. If he said left, I said right. If he said up, I said down. That's why I went to school. I wanted to show him that I knew more about restaurants than he did. I wanted to prove that I was right and he was wrong. But I was wrong. I was wrong.
No, you weren't wrong. And neither was he. It's all part of growing up, part of life.
It's a part I want to take back and do over again. I thought he was dead. Now I have a chance to change what happened, and he won't let me. He won't come home. I just want him to come home.
Me too. Me too.
Now, at the inn, Alan enters the darkened kitchen. He slowly walks across the room past the clean counter and turns on a light in the alcove. Reaching up to the high shelf, he removes the folder. He turns on the main kitchen light. He sits down on a stool at the counter, then opens the folder and dumps out the contents. A small, hard object falls out. He picks it up. It's the arrowhead. The flat, triangular stone is smaller than his thumb. Its tip tapers to a point. The base has a notch on each side. He turns the arrowhead over, rubbing its rough gray surface with his fingers. He lays it aside. He lifts a green and white menu. A golden letter A, written in decorative script, curves across the cover under the restaurant's name, Allen's. He opens the menu and scans the choices. He closes the menu and picks up a snapshot of a smiling 2-year-old boy sitting at the wheel of a car. The boy's blonde hair peeks out from underneath the wide brim of a grown-up's hat. Alan's cheek twitches as he looks at more pictures, one after the other. Chris and Paul sitting with Alan in a swimming pool. Chris holding a soccer ball. Paul wearing a red shirt in a portrait. Chris wearing a blue baseball cap and uniform with a catcher's mitt. In a flashback, Chris steps past their front door and smiles.
Chris.
Trembling, Alan stares at the photo. Alan picks up another photo. In it, Linda smiles broadly, her blonde hair tousled. In a flashback, Linda turns her head and smiles. Staring at her picture, Alan starts to weep. Later, Alan steps out into the dark courtyard. He stares at the door to Andy's office, then walks over and opens it. Andy looks up from her desk with a smile. Alan stands with his hands in his pockets. Andy's smile fades.
What?
Alan takes a few steps closer and gazes down at her.
I looked at the pictures. It's all coming back to me.
I don't want to have this conversation.
We have to.
Why?
Because that part of my life is real now. We can't just wish it away.
Oh, I can't.
I can't.
He touches her shoulder.
Your life is here now.
He sits down.
No. I'm just a visitor here. I have a life. I remember it. I miss my family, my wife, my boys. I'm Alan Grant from Omaha. And I want to go home.
You made promises to us.
I made them out of love.
Oh, is that supposed to make this easier for me?
No, it makes it harder. For both of us.
Oh, it's hard for everyone. Do you think that... that I have never imagined what your wife has been going through. I know what it's like to lose someone you love.
Alan drops his gaze. Her eyes full of tears, Andy gets up and paces.
When will you be leaving?
Tomorrow morning.
Andy squeezes her eyes shut.
Well, you better talk to the boys before you go.
Her lips trembling, Andy leaves Alan alone in the office. Alan sits with slumped shoulders. He blinks slowly. Morning in the living room.
Why can't you just go visit there and come back?
I can't do that, Justin. That's where my life was before I came here. It's important that I go back to it. It's not something that I can visit. It's not something I can just leave behind.
What we are.
Andy stands nearby, her arms folded. Alan reaches for the boys.
Come here.
Andy turns away as Alan sits down on the floor with her sons, holding their hands.
You guys, nothing I could say would make this pain we're feeling go away. None of us... ask for this. I love you, Mom. I love both of you.
But you'll forget all about us.
I want you to understand that we're part of each other's lives now. I want to see you grow up.
No, you won't. You'll be too far away. You'll never come here.
I will. Believe me, I will. Right now it's just a promise, and all I ask is that you give me a chance.
Can we call you sometimes?
Sure you can. Yeah.
Okay, guys. I think you should go outside. Alan's gotta go.
Alan reluctantly lets go of the boy's hands. Andy opens the door and the boys go out.
Get in a minute.
Alan kneels on the floor, his head bowed. Andy gazes down at him from across the room, her face streaked with tears.
You can be there for the boys.
But you can't be there for me. Once you go, you go. I'll be fine.
A tear runs down Alan's cheek. He wipes his face with his hands, then stands up and starts toward Andy. She turns and leaves the room. Alan watches her go, then walks out the front door. Now in Omaha, a taxi comes to a stop in front of the Grant house. Alan gets out. He pays the cabbie. The taxi drives away. Alan puts his hands in the pockets of his jeans and looks around, then walks up the path to the house. He hesitates at the front door, then rings the bell. Inside, Linda sits at the dining room table, typing on a laptop computer. She gets up and opens the door. She gapes at Alan. He licks his lips nervously.
Hello, Linda. If it's still okay with you, I'm home.
Linda nods. With a warm smile, she takes a few steps back into the house.
Come in.
Alan enters and closes the door. Together, they walk slowly into the living room. Alan runs his hand along the rustic wooden mantel of the red brick fireplace. An assortment of Native American pottery sits on a traditional woven rug. A glass case holds a display of arrowheads. Alan turns to face Linda with a tentative smile.
It's funny, I didn't think I'd be this nervous.
It must have been hard for you to leave.
It really was.
Linda bites her lower lip.
I don't want you here because you feel obligated. I mean, if that's the way you feel, you're free to go back. It's okay. Well, I mean, it's not okay, but it's...
You found me. You never gave up. I'm here because I've loved you all my life. Because I know now I can't live without you.
Alan reaches out for her. She welcomes his embrace. The front door opens.
Dad!
Paul and Chris come in. Chris runs to Alan and hugs him.
Hey, guy.
Chris takes off.
Where are you going?
Chris races down the hall. Alan gazes at Paul.
Hi, Paul.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm okay now.
Chris runs in, holding one hand behind his back.
What you got there?
Chris tosses a mitt to his dad. Alan kisses Linda's hair and starts to follow Chris. He stops and hugs Paul.
I love you, Paul.
Watching them, Linda smiles. Alan pats Paul on the back, then looks at Chris.
Come on, let's work on that curve.
Alan follows Chris outside. Near the door, the wedding photograph of Alan and Linda sits framed on an end table. Feet to black.